On Election Day, who better to talk to than Greg Palast? He's the guy who exposed the fake felon purge that removed 57,000 to 97,000. 57,000 to 97,000. Two different figures are out there. Maybe 10% were actual felons. But 57,000 to 97,000 were removed from Florida's voter rolls in 2000. And you recall Bush won the state by 507 votes. Now, Palast has new information. 3 million ballots were cast but not counted in 2004. He has a story of Republican caging lists and felons of the future. In his new book, Armed Madhouse, Palast takes readers on his new global tour from Baghdad to New Orleans, from Osama's cave to the Pentagon's back rooms. He exposes official mendacity and corporate malfeasance. The subtitle, and this is a mouthful, is Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf? China Floats, Bush Sinks, The Scheme to Steal 08, No Child Behind Left, and other dispatches from the front lines of the class wars. Greg Palast, whose book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, was high on the New York Times bestseller list for 7 months, won the George Orwell Courage in Journalism Prize for reports for BBC television, and he was honored as Guerrilla News Network's Reporter of the Year. An expert on Enron, electricity market manipulation, Palast is co-author of Democracy and Regulation, the United Nations Guide to Control of the Utility Industry. Greg Palast.
Hey, brother. Glad to be with you, Terrence.
Okay.
For those who don't know Greg Palast, I'm BBC investigative, television investigative reporter. I moved to London because I can't do it in the U.S. You know, it's against Patriot Act 3. So I had to move to London. I've come back now, though, to try to bust through the electronic Berlin Wall, and that's... And that would not happen without KPFK. I mean, all my reports I give, I've made arrangements to give to Amy Goodman for Democracy Now. I should also say that ABC Television has the right to run all my BBC Television reports. You know how many they've run?
Let me guess, 2.
No, come on. Do better than that. Zero.
None, zero.
Never, never, nothing. Are you kidding? You got to be kidding. No, or, you know. It's not like CBS would run it either. That, you know, that eyeball there is not really an eyeball. It's a pimple on the corporate rectum of violence.
You know, I was actually one thing that you just alluded to. I was going to ask why you decided to come back to the U.S. after the years in the U.K., and what is that?
Well, because we have to tell the truth. I mean, that's why I wrote Armed Madhouse, because they, you know, until Patriot Act 4, you can still read books. I mean, they know who's reading it, but good. We'll all gather up for a discussion of our madhouse in the Pacifica wing at Guantanamo next year, okay?
Right.
I don't know if you read, because I didn't hear if you read the full title of the book, which is
well,
out.
I haven't yet, but I plan to.
Okay. The reason is that it's the longest subtitle in the planet. Our madhouse's subtitle is Who's Afraid of Osama Wolf? China Floats, Bush Sinks, The Scheme to Steal 2008, No Child Behind Left, and Other Dispatches from the front lines of the class war. And that's what it is. It's a class war boot camp. We're going to discuss, you know, my last book, Best Democracy Money Can Buy, busted open the fact that, golly, they don't count all the votes in America, and how, you know, and that story was about how they scrubbed tens of thousands of black folk off the voter rolls of Florida before the 2000 race. That was Jeb Bush and Catherine Harris, and gave little George the White House. This book does give the real details of 2004. I mean, if you had an appetizer, if you read the Rolling Stone piece, and
you were a lone voice at times, I think, during the 2000 election and its aftermath.
Oh, yeah.
It seems like, have things gotten better or worse in terms of at least who's looking at things and talking about them since then?
I think it's worse, and I'll tell you why. Before, after all, when I did report the theft of the 2000 election... And by the way, when you say alone, I was alone with you. I mean, you let me on the air.
That's right. And
that's not a small thing. I couldn't break through the electronic Berlin Wall, and you know, the Terrence McNally program was one of the first places that allowed me to make this report with Amy Goodman and up in KPFA at Flashpoint. And, you know, what I was reporting on BBC of wiping out the voters. Now, it's even the... Even mainstream media has now accepted that story as fact, for the most part, with, you know, Fox is still resisting. But, yeah, they say, oh, yeah, black people, golly gee, there was a mistake. And the New York Times actually ran the story for the first time of the voter purge in Florida of 2000. In 2004, to tell you everything was fixed now. It's okay. Well, it is fixed, but fixed in another way.
That's right.
And what's shameless about it is that when I ran that report, you know, and it was before Michael Moore took it across, you know, at least they had the excuse like this was like outrage. You know, it was so beyond imagination that America could pick a president via an electoral coup d'etat, which is really what we had. That, you know, it was just outside the thinking. Now we should be looking at this, and it's in our face. 2004 was bigger, was nastier, was vicious stuff. In fact, one of the things in our madhouse you'll find is that one of the little nasty secrets of American democracy, and our media will make sure it stays secret, is that 3.6 million votes, over 3 million votes, were actually cast and never counted in the 2004 election.
Yeah, let me read just a quote from the book, okay? On November 2nd, 2004, in the state of Ohio, 239,127 votes for president of the United States were dumped, rejected, blocked, lost, and left to rot uncounted. And if you were a black voter, the chance of you losing your vote to technical errors in voting machinery is 900% higher than if you were white. But the shoplifting of those votes in Ohio was just the tip of the theftberg. And then you point out 3.6 million never counted.
Right.
I've interviewed Mark Crispin Miller. I've seen Bob Fetrakis speak. I've looked at RFK Jr.'s piece. And then I also looked at Farhad Manjoo's response in Salon. Have you read that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
He attacked me when I wrote Kerry won in the 2004
right.
race. He went on a vicious personal attack. He didn't bother looking at any of the numbers. He just, said, silly stuff. Well, if this such a wide spread theft occurred, the press would have reported it.
Oh, jeez.
But I answered, they did. It was on the top of the nightly news, except that was BBC television.
So for people, because I want to move on to some of the actually things that are more more hidden, maybe even than this, in terms of Iraq and Venezuela, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah.
I want to get to that. But for people, just if you can headline it, what is new in your analysis of 2004, and what would you consider conclusive?
Conclusive. It's not Ohio is the answer. 3.6 million votes were cast and not counted in the 2004 election, up from 2 million votes cast and not counted in the 2000 election. It's not Greg Palast black helicopter stuff. I used to teach statistics. We went into the computers of the Election Information Administration and got this stuff, and the ugly thing, it's not just anyone's vote that isn't counted. It is, I figured, 88% of the vote not counted in the United States, cast ballots thrown away, rejected for some reason, 88% cast by voters of color. You like that one?
It's amazing.
We have an untied electoral system, which is done on a very fancy, selective, statistical basis. It's not someone there looking for black voters and erasing that vote. It's much more complicated. And it's much more, it's deviously interesting, actually.
Well, one of the counterintuitive things, Greg, is that one of the groups of votes that weren't counted, I think something like 500,000, were absentee ballots.
Yeah.
And I would guess that people of color file less absentee ballots.
Right. Well, actually.
So that means they've got to really have nailed them in the other categories.
The one, there's a whole new flavor of ballots junked in this election, which built up the numbers. Provisional ballots, 1.1 million ballots. 3 million ballots voters were shunted to these back-of-the-bus baloney ballots. And we'll discuss it Friday night. 1.1 million of those were thrown away, and that was due to a mass challenge effort by the Republican Party. One thing that Manjoo doesn't touch, look, BBC, in my BBC investigation, I was able to suck down out of Republican National Headquarters computers. And we caught them, and they finally fessed. They had literally hundreds of thousands of names. We got about 60,000 of them, of African-American voters subject to challenge because of so-called suspect addresses. And let me tell you, go into the suspect addresses, Terrence. You'll see page after page after page of African-American soldiers shipped overseas. What they did was they sent them letters at their home addresses that said, do not forward. So the letters were returned, not sent on to Baghdad or Germany. And then they used those returned letter receipts to challenge their vote. just like the felon purge of 2000, which took 4 years for the U.S. press to accept as fact.
Okay.
The purge of the black soldiers and the purge of innocent black voters for suspect addresses in the last election is the great unreported story, and it's a million.
Okay, very good. And what to look very quickly at 2008, what's wrong with the new ID laws in your eyes?
No kidding. Well, first of all, there's only one purpose for a new demand ID when your signature used to be fine. Supposedly to stop the crime of people stealing your identity and voting in your name. Well, guess what? We had nearly 100 million voters. I'm looking for three cases nationwide. I haven't found one yet of voter identity theft. You know that? So we are now in the last election, 300,000 people were turned away from the polls for so-called wrong ID in New Mexico. I mean, case after case where Jorge Rodriguez, who had the Jorge Rodriguez on his driver's license, lost his vote because it said Jorge Luis Rodriguez on the voter registration.
In California, when they have begun to institute this new ID check, not even an ID card, but this ID check, that it tossed out 43% of the first group that they looked at in L.A. And as I said to people, myself, Terrence McNally, if by chance on one of those the MC, the C is a capital, and in the other one the C is small, I'm going to get kicked out from the right to vote.
Well, and it's very selective. It's like the new literacy test. We are finding in places like this is, by the way, aimed at the Hispanic vote.
I would think so.
Okay, this is what it's all about, just like the war on immigrants. And by the way, before you do vote today, and the elections chapter is important. You can't shoplift Mesopotamia until you shoplift the White House. But in Armed Madhouse, this is only one of five chapters.
Right.
We've got a lot to discuss.
Right.
No, I mean, we can't do it all now,
right.
But I do hope that before anyone votes today, if you aren't convinced yet, I want you to read about Mr. Ken Lay and your governor in the chapter called When Arnold Got Laid, and then you vote, okay?
Yeah.
That's very important. Vote with that in mind, and you can get that, even though it's in the book, you can get a chunk of that at gregpalast.com.
Exactly, and very briefly, what that is how before he had even decided, or before he had even announced that he was running for recall, Arnold Schwarzenegger was involved in meetings with Ken Lay and others.
And Mike Milken, the convicted billion-dollar stock swindler, they had a private meeting in the Peninsula Hotel. And May 21, 2001, Lay was already under investigation for flickering the lights in California, and Gray Davis had demanded, imagine, a dull guy like Gray Davis suddenly got up at his hind legs and said, we got to give back the money, Ken. And there's nothing that scares these guys more. I mean, they fear giving back the money more than going to jail. Ken Lay said, we need someone in Sacramento. This is what the inside documents show. We need someone in Sacramento who will reach a settlement.
That's
with us.
Right.
And indeed, once the Terminator became governor, within a couple weeks, hey, Kenny Boy and the rest of the Power Pirates ended up paying a nickel on the dollar, and that settled the claims. That's, so the big tough guy ended up being a little pussycat.
Well, especially when you consider his big claim was, I've got to come in and take care of the debt situation in this state. And so what did he do? He went for a nickel on the dollar on up to $9 billion in money that had been taken.
Blown away, baby.
What's up with you and peak oil? I've looked at what you've written about it, and I've looked at what some people have written about what you've written about it. And I have been one who's had several shows about the condition of oil in the world. And let me see if I've got the nuance right, just to be sure that we can get this done as quickly as possible, okay? That most people say that when we reach peak oil, which all peak oil means is that we have removed half of the oil from the Earth, from the Earth's crust. Okay, correct? We agree so far?
Well, no.
No?
The guy Hubbard, who came up with, who is called the, it's often called Hubbard's
right.
peak, though we
right.
never use the term peak.
Right.
It's real simple. We move from, as he said, we don't run out of oil. We move from what light hydrocarbons to the heavy stuff.
Right.
I'm writing about an armed madhouse. I don't really care, per se, about the nuances of peak oil so much as the geopolitical earthquake that's happening right now.
Right. Well, let me just, as long as oil is cheap, then if someone says, well, if we get the first half, the cheap, the low-hanging fruit, it's going to get really expensive after that, so we got to deal with that. What you say is, yeah, but when it gets expensive, then we have more oil, because some of the stuff that's hard to get to suddenly becomes attractive. Well, and then you point out that a lot of that stuff is in Venezuela.
Not just a lot. According to the inside documents, one thing you'll find in our madhouse is a lot of inside documents where I actually show them to you. And this is very important for understanding the war in Iraq and the war and the coming war in Venezuela. Okay, according to the U.S. Department of Energy, in a document that they don't want you to see that I got a hold of, 90% of the world's heavy crude, heavy oil, is in Venezuela. 90%. And that amount of oil is five times as much as the total reserves of Saudi Arabia.
Okay, now that is a blockbuster piece of
that
information.
And I went over that, and I met with President Chavez last month in Caracas. The issue there is not how much oil we have or not, but who's going to get killed over the oil where. That's a real big issue, because George Bush's idea of exploring for oil is to have Reverend Pat Robertson run out and say, Hugo Chavez thinks you're trying to assassinate him, and I think we ought to just go out and do it. And that is the real issue, the next oil war. Now, one of the points I try to make, I have a chapter on the secret oil wars in Iraq, and I know some of the conspiracy nuts out there listen to your show think that Bush had a plan to grab Iraq's oil fields before the tanks rolled, and as I explained, that's not true, because he had two plans.
That's right. That, I think, is one of the most interesting things. There's the neocon plan, and there's the oil
big
plan.
Oil, yeah. And they had two different goals, and big oil wins. See, because remember, the less oil, the higher the price.
The bigger
now,
the profits.
We can argue about how much oil there is of lighter and heavy oil, whatever, over the long term. But let's look at it this way. We didn't suddenly lose all our oil in 3 years. When George Bush took office, oil was at $20 a barrel. And now it's $73 a barrel. Mission accomplished.
Yep.
What I thought when I began the investigation to Iraq is that big oil wanted Iraq's oil. Now what I find out, and I spoke, if I was wired when I spoke to some of these oil execs, and I got the document that took us 2 years to uncover, that they said didn't exist, big oil's plan for the oil fields of Iraq. And it was not to get Iraq's oil, but to keep a lid on Iraq's oil, to make sure that they never produce more than 3 million barrels as dictated a day, as dictated by the Saudis and OPEC.
Okay, let me ask, this may be the last question. This is an oil-related question. Mm-hmm. What some people don't know is that when, up until 1970, America was the largest producer of oil in the world.
Yeah.
At the point at which it no longer was, it made a deal that basically set up OPEC with Saudi Arabia and other countries, and the rule was you had to trade oil in U.S. dollars, which meant that while we no longer led in energy, we basically were the banker, we were in control. Petrodollars.
Right.
Saddam Hussein was going off of the dollar onto the euro. We see what happened to him. Chavez, what is his status right now with regard to the euro, the dollar, etc.?
Well, the most important thing, it's not so much the question of which currency he's going to take. He has said to me, look, King Abdullah turns all his dollars back to the United States. In other words, basically, we paid $250 billion last year to OPEC countries. The Middle East returned every single penny of that came back in treasury bills and other U.S. investments from the Mideast. It just cycled right back, and that's what funded George Bush's oil wars, tax cuts for the rich, war toys, you name it. That's what Bush depends on to keep his scheme alive, is the petrodollar addiction. It's not the addiction to oil, it's the addiction to the petrodollar.
Exactly.
Hugo Chavez is putting George Bush on notice that it's going to be cold turkey, baby, if when the shift comes to Venezuelan oil. And in fact, Hugo Chavez, he says I'll sell you, by the way, oil cheaper than Saudi Arabia.
That's right. He's offering it right now at $50, isn't he?
That's right. But he said, but you don't get the dollars. The dollars for Venezuela stay in Venezuela and in Latin America to build our nation and our continent. And he withdrew $20 billion. From the U.S. Federal Reserve. So, I mean,
let me just say,
won't give them back.
Greg, hold on. What that means is Venezuela had invested previously, is what you're saying, in bonds, in those sorts of things. The same thing that the Middle Eastern countries are doing, the same thing that China is doing. And he pulled out. So
he
what he's saying
out
is,
and he relent the money to Argentina and Ecuador.
I'll sell you my oil at a better price, but I won't buy your bonds.
He said, no more. We can't be an oil colony anymore. I'm happy to give you oil. And, in fact, to low-income communities in the U.S. will give further discounts. But he said, we have to recreate our country. We can't keep giving you back the money. See, that's what it's really about.
I got to wind it up. Let me just ask one last question. This is a yes or no. Would you agree that what we've seen is Osama morphed into Saddam, and Saddam will soon morph into Chavez?
Yeah, they're Saddaming Chavez.